Thank you very much, CC. We'll move now to Richard, but well, don't, there will be more time for questions later. So Richard has a very interesting life story. He started in 1944 when he was born, and then at 15 he decided to join the Royal Australian Air Force as an apprentice in theater. He was there for 7 years when he decided he liked photography more than the Royal Air Force. So he moved to the Brand Art College and graduated after 4 years in a diploma in art design. And after that, was employed by the Victorian Plastic Surgery Unit as a clinical photographer. And as a photographer, he was invited to join the Australian University's expedition to Irian Jaya, the Castings Glacier, in 1971. And that was only his first expedition because he went back on a second one in 1972. So today he's here with the pictures that he made there as a scientific photographer in these expeditions that show us how Irian Jaya was before. So,
whatever
you
want, Richard. Okay. When I arrived I travelled from Australia to Indonesia, and when I arrived around the mine, I found these desolate native huts. These were living quarters, and the mine would destroy them after their period of work so that the natives wouldn't hang around. So it was a conscious policy of dissuading the workers from staying around where they lived. I was joined the group late and flew by helicopter up to the site where we camped for 3 months. So this was the 24th of December. And on Christmas Day, the tents had started collapsing under the weight of snow. So I remind people, this is 4 degrees from the equator. The ground was, it snowed every day we were up there. We occasionally had a clear morning, but at 3,000 millimetres of rain a year, it was a very wet environment. One of the things that we did as scientists was to collect scat or dog poo and bring it back for analysis to see what the diet consisted of for these wild dogs. There were only two groups of mammals that lived or visited that area. These were the wild dogs, and also there were marsupial like rat that lived in the area also. And the dogs would come up to eat them. Yep, next one. We were visited by some of the locals. We woke up one day, I think it was about the 26th, and there was a wooden cross mounted near our campsite with a message that we managed to decipher that said, "Go away." And this group came over, about half of them armed with bows and arrows, and said we had to leave. And we couldn't disturb the ice because Jesus Christ lived under the ice. And we just couldn't. So at Alaga, where we'd landed to, there was missions, and so they'd influenced the beliefs. We negotiated, mostly in broken Indonesian, and had three people stay with us as to watch we didn't do the right thing. We didn't do the wrong thing. It proved too cold for them because they weren't dressed as we were dressed. So they went down to the mine and negotiated a 6-week stay for us at that stage. So we were doing what we were doing with the permission, but for a limited time after the bad experiences they'd had with the mine. This is the sort of country where the glaciers had moved down and carved out enormous amounts of rock. And when the glaciers stopped advancing with the warming, the ice would retreat and leave mounds of rock. It was a rough area. We wore crampons, had ropes, did all the things that people have to do when you've got crevasses. As the ice moved over the mountain, curves of the mountain, it cracked open. And then after a snowfall, you'd have a snow bridge across that. And you could tread on that and just disappear. So most of the time working on the ice, because of the snow, had to be roped together. A lot of our work was done on the rock, because an important part of the work was actually establishing the amount of ice, how fast it was flowing, what was happening to it. There's a group, three of the team, and you can see the meltwater channels and the sort of conditions that we worked there. Again, another meltwater channel. These tended to flow down off the form lakes in places and also disappear into the limestone. The area is mostly limestone, and there's sinkholes where the river actually flows, disappears, and then reappears further down the valley. We had to establish stakes so we could measure the ablation, the amount that the snow was being blown away or melting, or the accumulation, how much it was growing, and also how fast the glacier was moving. So we'd install these stakes, establish them very accurately. We didn't have global positioning things in those days. We talked about 43 years ago. And then go back a year later and measure how much these stakes had moved. You can see two of the team with the brace and bit going through the snow and about to set up some stakes. Sometimes to get to the ice, you had to dig snow out of the way. So they dug snow pits, they did core sampling of the ice and collected representative samples. Because of our atomic tests in the 50s and earlier, there's a layer of the Earth that you can measure very accurately. So once you got to these isotopes, you knew exactly what the conditions were at the time of the atomic tests, atmospheric tests. So we used a 10-metre ice corer and physically drilled a core of ice up to take samples to analyse those back in Australia. And that's one of the ablation stakes about to go in. As well as that, there were lakes, and so we studied the cryoplankton and the various collected samples of what was living in the lakes. We took a rubber dinghy with us, rowed across them, took temperature probe samples at different depths of the lakes, and got up water samples to see what was actually living in them. Yep. Another interesting bit of it, on the left it's Randall Champion from the Met Department, who established the contact with the mining company and set up the first expedition. And Jeff Hope from ANU, I think, at that stage. He has a gravitometer, I think it's called. And it's a vacuum flask with a very, very fine spring in it and a weight. And they actually measure gravity and changes in gravity to establish, because rock is a different density to ice, they were establishing the thickness of the ice by using a gravitometer to measure the quantity of ice that was there. That had to be carried up in a backpack, flown on the plane. You couldn't tilt it or lie it down sideways, or you'd snap the spring. So it was quite a delicate instrument that was nursed all the way. Let's say, establishing levels, we took theodolites and levels to establish the different points on the glacier to get the flow rate. That was an interesting process, because every day the wind would come up and you'd see the cloud come up the valley. And when it got to where we were, we had to stop working. but occasionally there were storms, thunderstorms, and being with a metal theodolite on top of a mountain, because that was where you did your surveying from, was very dangerous. You'd feel the electrons making your hair stand on end, physically stood on end, and you could hear the sound of these electrons flowing through you. And when that happened, you very quickly moved away from the theodolite and packed up for the day. This was taken by one of the other members. That's on the centre figure there, looking a bit like the Three Stooges. Interesting thing, Ian, the glaciologist that was with us, was exactly twice my weight. And so I made a case that my pack should be half the size of his pack. And he agreed to that, provided I only got half rations. I let it drop after that. That's Ian going up carrying some of the stakes that we sunk into the ice. Thanks. Again, at the point where the snow and the ice. So you had accumulation of snow and ice, and as the ice gradually compacted, actually the snow compacted, it formed ice and then flowed down the mountain. Thanks. And people commented on the coloured lakes. This isn't a great picture of them. Fortunately, over the 40-odd years, the light has changed colour slightly. But bright blue lakes and green lakes. And this was, we think, the cryoplankton that lived there. The other thing we found in the ice was small birds and butterflies. They got blown up and died on the ice, and so got preserved there. And amongst the trials and tribulations of living for a number of months in a tent, there were very bright moments of joy, and this was the achievement of a upside-down pudding in a tent after a couple of months. We were visited up there by some of the Freeport helicopter pilots, and they gradually got mountain sickness over the period of one night. And it was interesting to watch because we were photographing them and they just sank before our eyes. When I flew in the first time, I, with a surveyor from Sydney Uni, we both got mountain sickness. The others had gone up about a week or two before us, so we were flown in by helicopter directly to that height and we both got very sick. I believe when the Indians and the Chinese had a border skirmish at that sort of altitude, they lost more soldiers to mountain sickness than they lost to bullets. It is a horrible thing. When I was on the Annapurna Trail, quite love doing a walk, a young German doctor flew in, 37 I think he was, and he was dead in 24 hours. So the chap from Sydney Uni, Ted, had to go back. I walked him down to the mine with one of the others and he flew back to Australia. I was still feeling as if I was recovering, but on the trip back up to our site, I crawled the last 200 or 300 metres because I was not feeling very well. So it was fairly remote and but a fabulous opportunity. The second time I went in, we flew into Ulaga. Now, we arrived at the airstrip. It was one of those airstrips that go up the hill. So the plane comes in and squashes out and comes to a halt going uphill. And there was a crowd, probably 200 people, gathered around the airstrip. We thought, this is great, a welcoming committee. Then we found out that they'd come to see us crash, because that was the very first time a two-engine plane had landed at the Ulaga airstrip. And our team of six or seven fitted into this small two-engine plane, but none of our supplies did. So that was coming the next day. So we just had tents, sleeping bags, and us. Well, it was 6 days before the weather cleared that the plane could attempt another trip. And so we traded with the locals for small tomatoes and a tuba of some sort. And I don't think I've ever been as hungry in all my life. I was craving meat or fish, anything. Well, we waited for our supplies to arrive. And from there we had a 6.5 day walk up about 3,000 metres to get to the mine site with probably 20, 30 porters helping carrying the gear, all the scientific stuff and our supplies for 3 months. And that time there was no question of any mountain sickness because we'd had time to acclimatise. We did have some Indonesian students join us from the Mapala, the Indonesian university, for a brief time. They had a mountaineering club that had made a previous visit to the glacier, and they knew of some rock caves where people camped to protect from the weather. They weren't big caves, they were shelters really. And that was a site that we got a lot of animal bones and charcoal, which assisted in identifying the range of animals that had lived in that area. I mentioned earlier that I had trouble leaving and had to stay an extra few days by the airstrip, and that was an opportunity to meet some of the locals rather than the Indonesian soldiers with guns. And I traded about everything that I had. So I came back with my trousers held up with a bit of rope, but I had wonderfully armed, lovely bows and arrows and headdresses and stone axes and adzes that was great to bring back. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Well, they've seen geologists and all sorts of groups with scientific background coming before. I think they are still very suspicious.
Right. Mm.